This podcast of Word of Mouth is supported in part by Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine, information at doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk to you again.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's a lab in Minneapolis that has a Guinness World Record certified anechoic room. It's touted to be the world's quietest place. The room has been rigged to be 99.99% sound absorbent. It is so unnervingly quiet that the longest anyone has been able to stand being in the room is 45 minutes. People begin to hallucinate in the absence of external sound. They become disoriented, hearing only the beat of their heart and their breath entering and exiting their lungs. Unlike meditating in a quiet place, it is completely still. And people begin to feel a little mad. Silence is powerful. But as Joel Beckerman says, sound is also what anchors us in our world. Joel is an award-winning composer and producer for television and founder of Man-Made Music. That's a company specializing in sonic branding. And his new book is called Sonic Boom. Joel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Virginia.
So what happens to people inside of this anechoic chamber in Minneapolis?
Well, as you said so correctly in your intro, it is completely unnerving to be in an anechoic chamber because we are used to having this soundtrack around us all the time. Even if we think it's quiet, there's always something to listen to. So in that chamber, you do begin to hear the only thing there is in the room, which is yourself. And you start hearing your heartbeat, and you start hearing, if you hear a high-pitched whine, you actually hear the electromagnetic waves from your brain, and you're actually hearing these things, which is one of the reasons that you become so unnerved.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant experience from
what I
understand.
I guess it's not like, you know, does the Dalai Lama experience that? Do we know?
I don't know. I think he seems a little too calm for that, I would imagine. But I think the point really is that we cannot escape sound. It is around us every single moment of our entire lives, and we may not be aware of it.
Well, we're told now that we're in a visual culture, but radio, my field, is of course dependent on sound. And when silence happens in radio, we call it dead air. You know, we dread it. How does sound anchor us in our world?
Well, I would actually argue that we're in a visual medium storytelling world because the fact is that television and film really is a sonic medium. Have you ever tried to watch a television show or watch a movie without the soundtrack? You just don't know what's going on, and there's nothing to anchor you into that experience. There's actually some amazing research that was done by Anirudh Patel, who's a professor at Tufts University. And what he did was he took a clip of a film, and then he put a variety of different soundtracks behind it. And you just imagine, oh, well, different music might trigger different emotional responses. But that really was just table stakes. What it showed, actually, is that the music that was played behind the clip changed your perception of the relationship between the characters on the screen. It changed your perception of what their backstory was. It changed your perception of the trajectory that the story was going to take. So actually, music and sound is incredibly powerful. It gives us this amazing treasure trove of information in just a very, very short period of time, really in an instant.
And you mentioned in the book that once a person begins to listen for the sound in their lives, that they can't stop hearing it. You know, it's like, you know, thinking about buying a new car or an orange car. You see orange cars everywhere. When you create sonic experiences in stores or for the Super Bowl, which is one of the things that you've done, is the idea that you don't hear it, but you feel it? I mean, if a person notices the sound, does that mean something is not quite right?
Yes and no. It really depends on what it is, what experiences we're trying to provide to people, what kinds of ways we want to engage them, bring them into an experience. So often, sound that is overt, right in your face, can be very, very intrusive. And actually, that's the kind of thing that really repels people, wants them to walk away from experiences. But every once in a while, those kinds of sounds, which are very what we call foreground sounds, can be incredibly appealing. A song that you love in a, for instance, in a motion picture, or maybe there is somebody's voice that is front and center that's giving you some information that you might really love, or an actor who's being very evocative and emotional in terms of what they're speaking about. And then there's the opposite, where music and sound can be the score, the very sort of quiet, subtle background for an experience. And it just triggers your mood, sets you down a certain path. So, for instance, we created for AT&T in one of their retail stores, which is actually called an innovation store. So it's a bit different than a typical retail store. We created an experience for them. So when customers walk into the foyer right at the beginning, there is a very, very sort of quiet ambience. It's barely something that you can recognize, but it does change your mood. And then there are all these sort of whimsical sounds that come up every once in a while. There's a little, there's a moment where there is, you hear a little firework, and there's another where you hear something spinning or whirring in the distance. And then you hear a little metal ball kind of going down almost a xylophone kind of stairway, playing actually the AT&T notes in a very quiet, subtle way. And it just sets you, it sets your mood, and it sets you into this place, this mindset, where perhaps you're going to be open and you're going to be a little bit, you're going to slow down. Then we also talk about mid-ground sound, and those are the things that are in the middle. So please, if anybody is doing this during drive time, don't do this now, but you can do it when you get home, or if you happen to be home right now, you can close your eyes and listen to the sounds around you, and you'll hear things that are in the foreground, the midground, and the background, and you can begin to identify them and pick them apart and really decide for yourself which of those sounds help your experience and which detract.
Well, you're talking about triggering sort of emotional responses and even, you know, somewhat transporting, I think, in time and space. How does sound affect some of the things that we use or are sold as products, like perceptions of flavor, for example?
Perceptions of flavor, amongst many other attributes of products and services, they're really completely dependent upon your sonic environment, which may not be at all obvious to you until you sit and think about maybe the last time you went to a restaurant. And let's say you went to a restaurant, you went there with some friends, and you want to have a conversation, and you want to enjoy some wonderful food. And let's say that restaurant is a bit loud, it's a bit noisy. So maybe 20 minutes in, you're starting to realize you're shouting across the table at someone. And so it begins to sort of irritate you, the background noise. Now the food shows up. And when the food shows up, perhaps the din of the noise around you, you're not really aware of the crunchiness of your vegetables or your salad. Perhaps you're overstimulated by the sound and the noise and the people on the table next to you. And let's say it's one of those restaurants where there's a lot of reverberation of the sound and they haven't really given a lot of thought to the materials and the dimensions and the architecture, which unfortunately is a lot of restaurants. Well, now what happens is all those distractions also impact your perception of the flavor. So food starts to taste bland to you. So think about last time you were on an airplane. That's a perfect example of where there's a lot of background noise. Now, maybe airplane food doesn't qualify as fine cuisine, but it definitely degrades your experience of whatever you're eating when all your senses don't come into play, because that's what is so marvelous about a great culinary experience is that all the senses are tied together.
Well, although they don't do it well necessarily, some restaurants and some retail spaces do carefully engineer how sound travels is used inside of their establishments. So there are places where sound, for example, keeps us in the store, you know, keeps us buying drinks. Is that allowed in? And there are others that, you know, they think, well, we want the table to turn over at X amount of time, so we'll make the sound a little louder. How does that work on us?
Well, there's a lot of research that shows that things like quick tempo music, more upbeat music, does tend to move people through spaces quicker. That slower tempo music does tend to have you slow down. So, and there are many other many, many other metrics about that in terms of background music. But the main thing is that if people – we're in an era now where people are incredibly savvy about these things. The sound in your advertising, the sound in your products, the sounds in the sponsorships and spaces, the sounds in the devices. If audiences feel that that sound is put there to manipulate you, you turn them off sometimes forever.
Hmm.
Now, the flip side is the companies that understand that really what people want is they want a relationship with these brands that they love. I know Apple has certainly taught us that amongst many other brands. Apple has this wonderful startup sound, very sort of warm and rich and mellifluous type of sound. It wasn't always that way, by the way. We talk about that in the book, that the initial Mac sound was actually a very, very discordant, sort of mechanical, everything went wrong kind of sound. But now the Mac sounds are very warm and welcoming. And Apple does a wonderful job with sound in their spaces and also in their devices.
Well, so that is about sound engineering on the end, on the product end. But there's also the selling of those products. And I want you to just talk about jingles, because these are things that stick in people's heads for years. Let's listen to just a few of them that we find the stickiest.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer wiener. That is
ice cold milk and an Oreo cookie made forever.
Flop, flop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
I am stuck on Band-Aid brand, cause Band-Aid stuck on me.
To be a pepper, drink Dr. Pepper.
So those are jingles that were written for products, but now brands are more likely to use ready-made, well-known pop songs for their commercials. So we don't hear the custom brand jingles anymore. What happened to the jingles? Did they find them no longer effective?
Well, jingles really became no longer effective because, again, now we're in an age where we don't want to be sold. So if you think about the Oscar Mayer Wiener song or other jingles that we know from decades ago, it doesn't really necessarily remind you, make you think about the product today. It actually makes you think about simpler times when you were younger, when all of us were younger. And that's actually the warm feeling we get now is really more about our own personal history and associated with it. So you'll notice that there really are very, very rare occasions, and usually they're comedic ones now, where brands will create brand new jingles. However, and you're talking about the popular music examples, which is great. Popular music actually can be very powerful. But there are also a lot of brands that have gotten themselves into a fair amount of trouble that way. One that comes to mind off the top of my head is Royal Caribbean, which is a cruise ship company. And they loved this song, Lust for Life. Which,
Iggy Pop?
You know, Iggy Pop, which, gee, it sounds so positive and up and energetic. But unfortunately, nobody bothered to really look at the lyrics and realize that the song was about a hooker and a heroin dealer. So that's an extreme example. But the public called out to Royal Caribbean, and this happens all the time now, where if brands are not smart enough to understand what the music means, and they really just try to sort of put it like a coat of paint on the outside of the barn of their brand, and they're not thinking about the meaning of it, it actually can have disastrous implications.
Joel Beckerman is an award-winning composer and producer for television and is founder of Man Made Music. It's a company specializing in sonic branding. His new book, written with Tyler Gray, is called Sonic Boom.
GTO, wear a uniform, a line of government loan. I'm worth a million.
Coming up, a Hollywood sound designer talks about his process for creating a demonic soundscape for the 2001 film From Hell, a murder mystery starring Johnny Depp. Listen for the sound of evil when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now, before the break, we spoke with the author of Sonic Boom about the power of sound. Now we turn to an artist who uses that power to enhance moviegoers' experiences. In this piece, produced by Jonathan Mitchell, Hollywood sound designer Steve Boedeker talks about his process of developing a soundscape, in this case for the 2001 horror film From Hell, starring Johnny Depp as an opium-addicted detective hot on the trail of Jack the Ripper.
This first one is, I just called it Opium Den, and it's just one of the elements that we used in some of these nightmares in From Hell. And so the idea is, okay, how can we sort of simulate the sound effect of just like going into this crazed opium haze? And I felt like it was like water seemed to be an overall theme of a lot of it. It was like, okay, let's get the feeling of like going underwater through sound. So start this guy. It's got a watery quality to it, but you don't hear specific bubbles or anything like that. And
what is the sound? What is the actual sound?
Oh God, I don't remember. This is one of those ones where it's this radically processed. I should have just written down what I was doing as I was doing it, but I just started going off. Played around a bunch. Oh my God, that is so cool. Playing around and stuff and experimenting. You know, you start kind of goofing around with things, and you sort of got to see where it's going to take you. And it's like, kind of going with that. Oh man, that was totally cool. As a sound designer, you can be a composer that has an unlimited palette of sounds to use in your compositions. And there's this sort of no man's land in between music and sound effects that you can do all kinds of things. So if you decide that at one point you need to have something be very intense and building and rhythmic, you can do that with anything. You can do that with a train building. You can do that with like low-end crashes that just build louder and louder and louder. Whatever you feel that you can sort of justify getting in there to help build that tension. Now these are I called opium whooshes, which are just used for transitions to get in and out of other sounds. Here's another one that I did that talk about playing around. This is a recording of a bunch of little kids singing London Bridge is Falling Down that I slowed way down and then I processed and modulated. And definitely the idea wasn't to hear them singing London Bridges. I just thought it was kind of a funny little joke that it was made from little kids happily singing. But you put this in his dream and use little bits of it as sort of a texture. It's just strange and creepy. There's a couple scenes that take place in a morgue, and it's like, okay, how can we convey a feeling of just creepiness? It's not so much scary, just creepy. It's like, okay, we get sort of low wind, and you just take some regular wind sounds and pitch them down and smooth them way out. And then stretch, stretch, stretch. And then add to that like some drips and things like that, and you get this pretty wet place. Another thing I added was just simple recordings of flies. Which to me says dead bodies. And it's like, yikes. There seems to be sort of two different types of scary. There's the type of scary where you as an audience member know what's going to happen and you're just waiting for it to happen. And then there's the type of scary where you don't know what's going to happen, but you know it's going to be bad. Like The Exorcist, when the mom's creeping around in the hall and she hears the rats up in the attic. We have no idea what's going to happen, but it's just scary as hell. And I think a big part of that is like less is more, you know. You want to hear her light padding footsteps on the carpet, and you want to hear the rats in the attic, and you want to hear the flicker of her candle, and not much more. You're almost leaning into the screen to hear.
Feels nice.
Oh, Carl. Jesus Christ, Carl, don't do that.
If you get to work on a scene that has, they kind of have their act together as far as what emotion they're trying to convey, it makes it really fun as a sound designer because you're already sort of where you want to be and you get a chance to sort of give people that extra nudge. Whereas the opposite is really difficult. If you don't feel like the scene is really working very well, but you know that they desperately want it to be scary or beautiful or funny, it's really hard. It's really hard. Because you really are working to support what you see. You know, sound is a really powerful thing, but it's the marriage of the sound and the visual that really does it.
That was sound designer Steve Boedeker talking about how he created a soundscape for the 2001 film From Hell. Some of his other projects include The Village, All Is Lost, and David Fincher's Seven. And that piece was produced by Jonathan Mitchell. When we return, we're going to move from an artist who makes sound for film to a musician who uses videos to make music. A conversation with YouTube mashup artist Kudiman when Word of Mouth continues.
I don't ever want to come down.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Ophir Kutiel, also known as Kutiman, is a musician born and raised in Israel. In 2009, he released a series of songs crafted entirely from unrelated YouTube videos, the same way a DJ might pull samples from all kinds of different records. For example, you might start with a drum tutorial illustrating how to make a slow groove beat. Then add a little of Pachelbel's Canon played on digital piano. Then maybe some vocals. In this case, an original song done a cappella into the built-in microphone of a desktop computer.
Don't know how you look me in the eye, trying to apologize. You lied to me for the last.
So each of these videos on their own might see a few dozen to maybe a few thousand hits. But put those and more than a dozen other amateur YouTube videos together, and you get something that has the power to go much, much further.
I trusted you, gave you everything. But when it's all said and done, it doesn't mean a thing. Had my heart from the very start, but now that I'm looking back, I guess I wasn't smart. How could you do this to me? I gave you life, I set you free. You meant more than words to me. You were my king, I was your queen. So I don't know how.
That's My Vendetta, one of the tracks off Kudiman's new album of YouTube mashups Through You Too, which he released online for free earlier this month. And Kudiman joins us now from Israel. Hello there.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Very well. We just heard one possible sequence or setup of how we'd put together a song. How about you? Do you have a regular process? You know, do you start with the vocals? Do you start with the drums?
No, usually I just run across one video that inspires me to start a new track, and then I search the rest.
You must spend a lot of time looking at videos online.
Yes, I watch a lot of videos, and it's pretty inspiring and amazing to see how much talent there is out there.
Yeah, there really is something. I mean, the music stands on its own, but the videos, there's something really touching about watching them. All of these people playing music alone, you know, often in their bedrooms or garages, and unknowingly you bring them together in your videos. There's something a little lonely about it. How does the video footage play a role for you when you're making these mashups?
Yeah, I take in consideration also the video. You know, sometimes I find something that musically fits, but the video doesn't work. And sometimes the other way around, like the music not exactly fits, but the video is amazing. So I have to work a lot to put it together. And I think there's something that people relate to the simplicity in the videos, you know, that it's real without all the makeup and flashes and the realness in it.
the spotlight in the videos really seems to be on the people, the artists that you sample. Now, you, however, are kind of a mysterious dude. Do you prefer to keep to the shadows?
Yes. I don't like the spotlight, really. And I just like to create music, you know, sometimes in this way from YouTube.
But this isn't even your main gig. I mean, you are a DJ that gets hired, you know, flies around the world to do big, big parties. What do? You wear dark glasses and a hat or something like that?
No. My main thing is producing, and most of my time I spend in a studio producing other artists or my own music. And I have my band that we go around a little bit, but nothing like with glasses and big hats.
Well, now you've made a big point of linking to all the videos you use in Through You and Through You Too, this second record. And you can even do a sort of split screen so people can see the simultaneous musicians in their separate little spaces coming together. Is it important to you that all the artists you use get credit?
Yeah, it's very important. I think it's at the end of the day, they are playing. I'm, you know, just putting it together. And I think it also gives people better view of how I build this, and they can go and see where the piano comes from and where the vocals comes from. And I think it's really exciting to see.
And to hear as well. So let's hear another track from the new album. This is Give It Up. This is from Kutiman's second album of video mashups, Through You Too. How many separate videos, if you remember, did you use to create this song, Give It Up, that we're listening to?
I think this one is around 23 different musicians.
Wow. So you loop little bits from individual ones and maybe bump up the sound in some and others?
Yes, exactly. I take like specific parts from each video and put them all together.
How long does it take to do that? 23 different videos?
It took the entire album with six tracks in it, like three months, something like that.
Wow. Are there particular instruments that are harder to find videos that kind of match up?
No, but sometimes it's really hard to find a vocalist, you know, to fit the scale and the tempo. And some scales are more difficult than others, but it's really like fishing, you know, just sit there and sometimes it comes fast, sometimes it takes longer.
Well, I've noticed that a lot of the vocalists you use are women. Is that an artistic choice, or is there just a better selection of female singers on YouTube?
Actually, on this project, I wanted to do all ballads with the female vocalists. Maybe next time I'll do the same thing with male.
Have you ever met any of the people that you featured in your videos?
I actually met one of the singers from the first Through You, Leslie, from the song called, I can't remember the song, but it was really touching and exciting to actually meet the real person behind the video, and it was amazing.
Well, she must have been happy too. Now, you know, some of your videos have been seen more than a million times.
Yes, she was very happy, and then and most of the comments I get from the musicians, they're really happy to find about it, and they're really excited about it, and some of them also get a lot of attention. I'm very happy about it.
Has anybody ever said to you, please don't use my video, I don't like it, what you've done?
No, not really. I had one misunderstanding with one musician. She thought that I'm selling it and making a lot of money and it's commercial. But after I talked to her, she understood, and now she supports the project and she loves it.
Well, let's listen to another track. This is No One in This World. Videos you see on YouTube of amateur musicians playing by themselves, sometimes doing instructionals. Well, our guest Kudiman is a musician and a video mashup artist, and he turns those into songs. His new album of online videos is called Through You Too. I'm thinking about what you said about the musician who wanted to know if you were making money off of her work. Now, some of these have been viewed on YouTube more than 1.5 million times. If those were album sales, that would be a platinum record. Do you have any interest in trying to make this project commercial?
Actually, not at all. It started as just something I do on my free time, and it is still something I do on my free time, and I just love doing it. And no, actually, not really looking for making money out of this.
I wonder if people are going to start pitching you, you know, sending stuff to Kudiman and saying, look, I did an amateur video. It's really good. What do you think? Could you use me?
I'm actually getting quite a lot of emails and people sending me their, you know, look, this is my daughter playing drums and this is my brother. And I love it, you know, and some of them I put aside, and maybe in the future projects I'll use them.
Wow, did you ever think of yourself, Kudiman, as a, you know, a star maker? You're giving people a bump.
I'm doing my best, you know. I don't know if a star maker, but I'm trying to show how much talent there is on YouTube, unused talent.
Well, Kudiman, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your talent with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Ophir Kutiel, he's also known as Kudiman, and you can check out his new album of YouTube mashups. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Definitely worth seeing. Coconut water, coconut oil, coconut milk shampoo. When Word of Mouth continues, a look into the booming industry of coconut products and whether those items live up to their claims or their price tags. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the break.
Nothing will keep us apart. You've got the key to my heart. I don't know if you can see how much joy you bring to me when you hold my hand and don't let go. If I haven't told you so, this is how I feel when you need me. This is how I feel when you hold me. I can't help it. I wish everyone could see that. This is how I feel.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Experience the ultra hydration of coconut water and wrap your skin in hydration with new Dial Coconut Water Body Wash.
Superfood? Nutritionists say no. Superior sports drink? Nope, there was a lawsuit over that claim. Better than soda? Pretty much. Prevents Alzheimer's, lowers your cholesterol? Definitely not. Making a whole lot of money? Oh, yes. Coconut water, cooking oils, lotions, and products now rack up about $500 million in sales in the U.S., a number that's doubled every year since 2005, according to the Wall Street Journal. Maddie Oatman looked into the mighty claims and high cost of coconut products for Mother Jones. That's where we found her article, Stop Going Cuckoo for Coconuts. Maddie Oatman, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So coconut water has been a staple in Brazil, parts of Africa, and Central America for a very long time. When did it hit it big in the U.S.?
Well, you know, coconut water was sold in, especially in health food markets, for a long time, for a couple of decades now. But starting in the mid-2000s, some entrepreneurs started selling it in New York City at bodegas. Vita Coco and Zyco launched simultaneously, kind of in the same week, back in 2004. Because they were inspired by how popular the drink was in Brazil and Central America.
Okay, so Rihanna drinks it, Giselle drinks it, Matthew McConaughey's invested in it. Why do you think it took off so quickly here?
You know, I talked to a food trends analyst named Harry Balzer of the market research firm NPD Group, and he made the point that the launch of coconut water kind of coincided with our excitement about all-natural eating and also our excitement about products that already had benefits like electrolytes or antioxidants naturally occurring. So we weren't having to add those things. I think another reason is just that, you know, it's exotic and it's a new product. It's exciting. And it doesn't have all the added sugars, say, of soda or Gatorade. Mm. The sugars are naturally occurring.
Well, let's stay with the drink for just a minute. What kind of health claims were made and were they ever proven?
Sure. Well, one of the health claims is that, you know, coconut water is full of electrolytes, which, you know, seems to be true. There are definitely some electrolytes in coconut water. But Vita Coco, for instance, exaggerated those claims a little bit by saying that coconut water had, say, 15 times the electrolytes found in sports drinks. That ended up not being true. So they were sued in 2011 and agreed to, you know, pay about $10 million.
So it's been kind of knocked off of its superfood status, but the coconut water success still has opened up a whole coconut craze. I mean, coconut oils and flours are selling really well. Coconut milk lattes at Starbucks. What are some of the advantages of those products or claims?
You know, coconut oil is popular because of its high flash point. So it, you know, burns at a much hotter temperature than olive oil. And it's also a great skin moisturizer. But, you know, if you're using it in cooking, one thing to note is that it's still mostly saturated fat. And eating too much of it could raise levels of a bad kind of cholesterol.
Well, as you point out in your article, what coconut products are good for are company bottom lines. So who's in the business and what kind of profits are they making off of coconut products now?
Coconut water companies seem to be doing really well. Vita Coco, for instance, owns about 60% of the market, and they're marketing things like flavored coconut waters, you know, pineapple-flavored coconut water, mango-flavored coconut water. And these products, on average, sell for about $2 for 12 ounces, and you can get about 32 ounces of Gatorade for that much. So you can kind of see that prices are a bit steeper for coconut water.
And who's in the business?
So you have Vita Coco is now distributed by Dr. Pepper Snapple Group and is a quarter owned by Red Bull China. Zyko is now owned entirely by Coca-Cola, and Pepsi owns most of One Coconut Water.
Well, we've seen this before, Maddie, with indigenous food staples kind of being seized upon by Americans and a global market. What can you tell us about the coconut supply chain? Where is it coming from? Who's being affected by it?
The supply chain still seems pretty opaque. It seems like the craze about coconuts, you know, the research about the supply chain hasn't quite caught up to that. But, you know, one thing to say is that when you look at the people who are picking coconuts in countries like Indonesia, the Philippines, and Thailand, a lot of them are living on very little a day and make very little for each coconut. So there was an Oxfam report that looked into coconut farmers in the Philippines, and they found that a lot of coconut farmers are living on about $3 a day at the height of the harvest season, and they make about 11 to 20 cents a nut.
Do people still have to scale the trees in order to get them? Is there any different way to harvest them?
Well, the ways to harvest are shaking the tree vigorously or climbing up it and picking the nuts. And because coconut water comes from less ripe green coconuts, I think climbing the trees is often the best way to get them. So you have farmers kind of making these dangerous climbs to pick coconuts and not necessarily making that much money off of each nut.
So what is a coconut lover who's concerned about sustainability options to do? Should we be using them?
Sure. I mean, my interest in writing this article and looking into coconut products is just that, you know, there seems to be this boom in sort of an infiltration of coconut everywhere you look. But, you know, when you realize that most coconut, you know, we harvest almost no coconuts in the United States, so starts to look a little suspect, you know, where are all these coconuts coming from? So my suggestion is just to, you know, buy products that are being a little more transparent about where they're growing their coconuts and products from companies who are working directly with coconut farmers. The brand Harmless Harvest, which has a pretty delicious raw coconut water that it sells, has a Fair for Life certification program, and they prioritize fair pay for their farmers. Another company, Big Tree Farms, is doing something I thought was pretty innovative, which is they actually sell dehydrated coconut powder. So you can make your own coconut water. It just means that they're not shipping large volumes of the water overseas, and that could reduce transportation emissions.
Maddie Oatman, thank you very much for making it a little more, the coconut supply chain a little more transparent for us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Maddie Oatman is the research editor for Mother Jones. There's a link to read her article, Stop Going Cuckoo for Coconuts, at wordofmouthradio.org. And she lists in her article some of the more sustainable or environmentally sound coconut suppliers.
We have ridden the length and breadth of the land in search of knights who will join me in my court at Camelot. I must speak with your lord and master.
What, ridden on a horse?
Yes.
You're using coconuts.
What?
You've got two empty halves of coconut and you're banging them together.
So? We have ridden since the snows of winter covered this land. Through the kingdom of Mercia, through...
Where'd you get the coconuts?
We found them.
Found them? In Mercia, the coconut's tropical.
What do you mean?
Well, this is a temperate zone.
The swallow may fly south with the sun, or the house martin or the plover may seek warmer climes in winter, yet these are not strangers to our land.
Are you suggesting coconuts migrate?
Not at all. They could be carried.
What? A swallow carrying a coconut?
It could grip it by the husk.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and poured up. She put the lime...
Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any part of the show or would like to listen later, you can catch up by subscribing to the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching for Word of Mouth on iTunes or at the link at wordofmouthradio.org. And please tell your friends that they can tune into Word of Mouth, whether they live in Berlin, New Hampshire, or Berlin, Germany. I'm Virginia Prescott. Spread it around and join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Doctor, ain't there nothing I can dig? I said, doctor.